Hello, podcast listeners. You are currently listening to Stories Past, stories told to students by me, Blake Smith, over the last 30 years. Hello, listeners, and welcome back to episode 3 of Stories Past, and I'm very excited to offer you my third story in our series, and hopefully you've got a chance to listen to the first two. If you don't, or if you didn't, please go back and give it a listen. In fact, today's story is kind of a spin-off of the first story about my first major job interview, and the story I plan to tell today is the story of my adventure in Washington, D.C. I attended Cortland State University, and my spring semester of my junior year, I in fact went to Washington, D.C. and served as an intern. The State Colleges of New York, SUNY, had a program where the three students from each college would go down to Washington and do internships in a variety of areas. And I was hesitant about doing it because I really loved Cortland, and springtime in Cortland was really fun, and I didn't want to leave. And I had been playing soccer, and I tore my ACL that fall, so I missed the entire season. And I decided to try. So I applied, and I was selected. So I got to go down there. I went with actually four other people from Cortland, and we stayed in apartments down in Washington, D.C., actually in Alexandria. And when we went in, we had to decide which area we would hope to be interns. And many of my friends decided to intern actually in congressional offices or Senate offices or committees. But I chose to work for a lobby group, which was also something that some of our SUNY students did take part in. But the one at this particular point in history, one of my main concerns was the nuclear threat. And at this point in history, America had the capability of blowing up the world about 7 times, something like that, and the Soviets maybe 3 times, and they just kept building more and more, and it just seemed to me as to be a waste of money and a waste of time and a waste of technology and also an increasing threat, because it almost appeared that the better the weapons got, the more likely they might be used. And so that was a major concern of mine, and so I did a little research, and I checked, and I selected this group, and it was called the Citizens for a Sane Nuclear Policy. It used to be SANE, which stood for Scientists Against Nuclear Energy, but then they kind of went away from against nuclear energy and kind of got more concerned about nuclear weapons and nuclear in general. And I worked in an office in the southeast of the Capitol, which was actually a residential area. I worked in a home that had been transferred into an office. And I worked specifically for a group called the Campaign to Stop the MX Missile, which I do not believe exists anymore because it's such a long time ago. And the MX Missile actually, we will learn, was approved and was put into silos. So my campaign didn't totally achieve what we had wanted, but that's part of the story. So I go down there. It was just the Campaign to Stop the MX Missile was one office in this building, and I was the only intern for this particular person. And it was a woman who ran the program, and I was her single and only intern. And it was really a great opportunity because I really got to dig deeply into a specific topic, that being the MX Missile. The MX Missile was a system that had been kind of bounced around between different presidents over time, and it was a perfect example of the problem of trying to satisfy the multiple branches of the military, because this system, you know, first they wanted it big, and then they wanted it mobile, and they wanted it mobile and big, and it just didn't really go together. And so ultimately, the MX missile was a missile system that would go into space, and it carried 10 warheads. They're called MIRVed weapons, and that means multiple independent reentry vehicles. And so this weapon would go up into space. That's what ballistic means, up into space. And it would be able to fly anywhere in the world and drop 10 separate atomic bombs on separate sites. And each of those atomic bombs were 20 Hiroshimas. And so if you think about that, that means one missile was 200 Hiroshimas. And we were supposed to build 200 of those when I was down in Washington, D.C. And so we were fighting, thinking that would be an overreach and way too much spending on these particular missiles. And then the interesting thing was that it actually started in Carter, and it may have started before that, and they wanted to build them out in the desert. And the idea was they were going to build these things out in the middle of the desert in Nevada. And they were going to create, it was called the racetrack. And it was like a shell game. They would have many, many silos all over the desert. And the fact is that when they made deals with the Soviet Union limiting nuclear weapons, they often limited nuclear missiles. They didn't limit nuclear warheads. So the way the United States got around limited number of missiles is they put a lot of warheads on top of one missile. And that's called MIRVing. And by the way, the Soviet Union copied us and got MIRVing as well. But what we're going to do is, since we could MIRV them, we weren't limited to the number of missiles. And what we would do, the idea was, is we would have these missiles on a system of railroads throughout the desert of Nevada. It was called the racetrack. And the theory was that the satellites would come over the top of over our country and look down. And there was a rule that you had to have your missiles open and kind of expose them so that the satellites could see them. But then when it was going back around the other side, you could move them. And so the idea was that the United States would have these missiles sitting there and then move them from silo to silo. So perhaps you had 30 or 10 silos for each missile. And therefore, that would be much more difficult for the Soviets to target these particular silos if you were able to move the missile from silo to silo. So this was the first idea. And that was a great idea. The only problem was it was going to use more concrete than the Hoover Dam and like more water than they had in the West. So that wasn't going to work. And so then it kind of passes on to Ronald Reagan. And Ronald Reagan decides that he is going to have to take that same missile system, and it was going to be called DensPack. And DensPack was he was going to put all the missiles very close together. And then when the Soviets attacked and the missile came in and it exploded over our densely packed atomic bombs, it would blow up, and then it would sort of like all the missiles wouldn't blow up and some of them would be able to get out, because that was what was DensPack idea. And it was just this crazy idea. There was some kind of belief that the initial explosion would cause other missiles coming in to be exploded and somehow allow these missiles to be released. So we called that DensPack because it didn't make much sense. And it went against the original idea, which was mobile. And so we had this big mobile missile, and now we have this big missile we don't have to do, and we're going to put it in the ground. So in the end, I'll tell you the end of the story, might as well. In the end, what they will do is they will take 50. They agreed to make 50, not 200, and they're going to end up putting them in existing silos in South Dakota, which I always thought was not a very good idea too, because you're almost, those silos are currently targeted already by the Soviet Union, so you're almost like putting a better target, although yes, a better missile, in a place that they already have targeted and could strike. So that was what happened in the end of the MX missile. So I spent a lot of time studying this MX missile. It was great. I was left alone a lot. I had this thing called the Sane bike. I would get on a bicycle and go whipping around Washington. My advisor would let me go off and just go and sit and listen to Senate hearings and committee hearings. And this is back in the day, pre-9/11. I remember I could take my bike and just drop it on the ground, kind of. I just said it there. Was kind of a junky bike. And I would walk up the steps of the Capitol building and go through security and walk right in. And I can remember that you weren't allowed to sleep, because I would kind of nod off sometimes and they would elbow you. You couldn't bring a pencil. That was interesting. You could not bring anything to write with. That was kind of strange, because I was wanted to take notes. But so it was very exciting to be in Washington. And one interesting thing I did one time was I delivered a letter from the campaign to stop the MX missile directly to every member of Congress. So I physically had letters in my hand. I walked to each office, and it didn't have a stamp on it. I physically delivered them. And I thought it was kind of interesting. I got to see every single 435 congressional districts and every single 100 Senate offices. I walked into each of them. And that was, I think, an educational experience for me, and kind of learning how each office was different. I also learned that we have congressmen from Samoa and the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico and American Virgin Islands. And they can't vote, but they do have offices in the same offices as the congressional representatives that do have the right to vote. So while I was down in Washington, as I said, I'm working for a group that is trying to stop nuclear missiles. Well, those groups, or what they called peace groups, were all kind of in group together. They worked together. And so I was working for this person. I don't want to say her name, but I just would work for this woman. And she said to me, she goes, you know, you really should get more involved in the peace movement in general, not just me, not just with a small group, the two of us. And I said, well, what do you have in mind? And she said, well, there's a freeze rally that's going to take place in Washington, D.C. It's coming up this spring. They're going to have it in Washington, right on the Capitol. And I said, oh, really? I said, what's involved? They said, well, they're going to ask to freeze the arms race. And she said, well, and there's an organizational meeting this week. And it's at this Catholic church in downtown Washington, D.C., and you should go down there and see if you can get involved. So I said, all right, I'll do that. So I'm 20 years old or 19 or something, and I go down to this meeting, and it was a church and a lot of people in there. And they were having a meeting, and they were basically going through and announcing or voting on who would hold particular positions. And so they had the director and the this and that, and they had all these different, the treasurer, and they kept voting and the vice president for this and that. And they were going down this list, and I'm just kind of sitting there watching, and they go, we're going to need a marshal coordinator. We're going to need a marshal coordinator. Anybody want to be a marshal coordinator? And nobody raised their hand. And so I said, yeah, I'll do that. And they go, okay, what's your name? And they wrote me down and said, come talk to me later. I said, all right, I'll do that. So marshal coordinator, didn't think, the meeting ends. I walk up, I said, well, what's marshal coordinator mean? And they said to me, well, basically, you're in charge of security for the event. And I said, well, what did you say? So, well, you have to kind of make sure that nothing bad happens at the event, at the rally. And I go, but aren't there police going to be involved in this at all? And they go, yeah, there's Capitol Hill police, but you have to provide your own security for the venue. The police will come in if necessary, but you have to provide your own security. And I thought, well, I don't know what I'm doing. I have no idea what I'm doing. So all of a sudden I kind of got this job that was way more than I expected, and I don't know how to do it. So they sent me to like Quakers who taught me about nonviolent resistance. So if people are attacking you, how do you defend yourself but don't fight back? And I did all this training, and I got into this whole kind of preparation study stuff, and time is passing. I met with a lot of people. But in the end, what had to happen was I had to get people to stand at different places and just kind of like filter people in. And so it was a kind of a VIP area, and there was kind of a media area, and there's different areas. We just kind of made sure people kind of stayed in their area. And this is going to take place on the Capitol steps. And this is on the Capitol side that faces the mall. And this is where the inaugurations take place since Reagan. And so we're going to be set up there. So this preparation takes place, and I've got to get security. And I'm thinking, I really don't know what I'm doing, but I've got to get people too. So I called all my friends from college and high school, and I said, you guys got to get down to Washington, D.C. I need people to serve as marshals in this particular event. So I was able to convince some of my friends to show up. And I can remember one specific story was quite interesting. Is my friend Jay Wilcox, the old Jaybird, was going to North Carolina State, and I convinced him to come up, and he probably hitchhiked from North Carolina State, which is Raleigh, to Washington, D.C. And on the night before, I told him I'd meet him at the Capitol, and it was 10:30 at night, maybe 11. It was late, and I told him I'd meet him right at the bottom of the Capitol building. And Jay was famous for wearing clogs, and so he was wearing these wooden clogs, and I'm sitting probably on Andrew Jackson's statue at one corner of the Capitol, and I see him coming right down probably Pennsylvania Avenue or Constitution or Independence, and I hear him clip clop, and I say, Jaybird, yell at the top of my lungs, and he starts clip clopping faster, Smythe, and I'm like, Jaybird, and I hid from him for a while and finally saw him, and it was great to see him, and I appreciated him making it the whole way. So, but to set up for this, you might wonder, like, why would you need security? It's a freeze the arms race. It's peace groups. You know, why would you worry about something like that? And the problem was that the opposite viewpoint was having a rally on the other side of the Capitol. So on one side of the Capitol, it's freeze the arms race. On the other side of the Capitol is peace through strength. And therefore the possibility for conflict is there. I did do some training with the Quakers, and I got pretty good at figuring it all out. And on the day of, I remember that I got to Washington very early, and I was standing up on the stage looking out on the mall, and the kind of the dew was kind of coming down, the fog was kind of settling. And I was thinking, you know, in a very short period of time, there's going to be
tens of thousands of people out here. And the purpose was for them, all the people to come to this event, to stand on the hill facing the Capitol, to hear speeches supporting a freeze of the arms race, reduction in the creation of nuclear weapons, and then for those people to go and actually direct lobby, which is why I tell this story, because as a government teacher, you have to teach about what is lobbying. And lobbying in this particular case was to go and to convince your politician, to convince your legislator, whether it be a senator or a congressman, that you're concerned about this and this is your opportunity to speak to them. And so for months on end, we had been trying to contact many, many congressional districts. And I think out of the 435, we got something close to 400, if I'm not mistaken, represented. And they all showed up. And we had signed up ahead of time to like appointments to meet with congressmen and senators. And I remember that Alphonse D'Amato, who was my senator, refused to meet with our group. And people went anyway and signed his book. And he did show up. If I'm not mistaken, I think he claimed that he was having a heart attack or something. I'm not kidding. I believe he said he was having health problems and he was whisked away because people were kind of demanding that he speak to us about this freezing of the arms race. So what ultimately happens now is that I'm waiting there and my friends show up and I had placed them at different important locations and there were barriers set up to keep people from different areas and people start pouring in and pouring in. And I'm walking around and there are many people who had volunteered. If there was probably 50 of us, oh, this is kind of a weird thing. We had to have some kind of a thing that marked us as security or as marshals. So I went to a fabric store and I found a roll of fabric it was red and it had dice on it, white dice on it. And I still have a piece of it. It's funny, but I cut up pieces of it. I gave everybody one and they tied it around their arm. And that was a symbol that they were part of the marshaling corps. And so I'm wandering around and I'm getting nervous and there's more and more people coming. And we're not quite sure who's going to speak, but we're pretty sure. And this man who was helping me, who had volunteered, came up and he said, I used to work on Secret Service. And I said, what? He goes, yeah, I'm kind of retired Secret Service. I said, well, I really not totally sure what I'm doing here. Would you just stand like right next to me the whole time in case I have a question so I could just ask you? He's like, sure, I can do that for you. So I said, wait, don't go anywhere. Just kind of stay right next to me all the time. And so I told him this and he was kind of going around and checking things out. And he said, now listen, one of the things you have to do is you have to get someone to stand up on that stage to help people up because there's older people going up there and they have to go up a ladder. So I have to take 3, 4, 5 steps on the ladder. They go up onto this platform and then speak before the crowd. And I said, oh, yeah, that's a very important thing. So I go and I start looking around. I said, well, I'll get somebody. He goes, no. This is your show. You do it. And I said, oh, okay. So I go up, climb the ladder. And now I'm standing on the stage all by myself. And then the event begins. And up comes, it was basically Alan Cranston and me. And then Ed Markey and me. And then, of course, Teddy Roosevelt. Oh my God, I just said Teddy Roosevelt. Stop. So suddenly, I am alone on a stage with Randall Forsberg, the director of the Freeze Movement, and Teddy Kennedy speaking on a platform on the Capitol steps in front of several thousand people. Now, the interesting thing is, if you think about it, at one point, I wasn't even going to do this internship and to get the internship and to go to Washington and to join this particular very small group and then to work my way to a situation in which I'm standing on stage with Teddy Kennedy. My father saw me on television that night, pretty amazing. And I did not expect to be on that stage. But what was most nerve-wracking for me was that I knew very well about the assassination of John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy. In fact, kind of, I was a little bit of an expert on it. I had been able to meet with G. Robert Blakey, who was a law professor at Cornell Law School, who was in charge of the investigation, congressional investigation into JFK's assassination. So I was really kind of, I wouldn't say taken by the, but I definitely did pay attention. I was aware of it. I did go to Dealey Plaza when I graduated from college. So JFK's assassination was always an important part of my life. And so when I was about to step up on the stage, this gentleman walked up to me and he was playing clothes policeman. He said, make sure there's no packages underneath that stage. And I said, well, why would that be a problem? And he goes, we don't have any bombs going off while you're up there. And so the whole time I'm standing up there, I was very nervous that something bad was going to happen. But luckily, nothing bad happened. And Teddy just talked about how that he was going to put forth a proposal to begin a reduction in the number of nuclear weapons stockpiled. And after all the speeches were done and the people had gone off to meet with their congressmen and express themselves, that was a long day for me. And the following day, I kind of went back to my normal job working at SANE and the campaign to stop the MX missile. But when I look back upon that adventure and that particular event in my life, I realized that it really did have an impact because I did some research. I went back. First of all, I found a C-SPAN coverage of the particular rally, and you can see me in it. It's amazing. I've told the story for years, and just I think last year, the year before, I found this C-SPAN. And in there is our rally, and you can see me clearly in the background. And behind, on the other side, is the rally for peace through strength with Newt Gingrich and Phil Gramm and others speaking. So this was quite an event. And the most important thing I think that came of it was that there was a reduction in nuclear weapons in this world. And it really did take place. I was looking at a graph of the stockpile of weapons, and the peak of the curve was right about 1985, 83, 84, 85, which was when I was fighting this fight. And today, the number of nuclear weapons that we have are greatly reduced relative to about 40 years ago. So that's something in terms of some success from a lobbying effort. And you can just see that sometimes that when you get enough people who agree to the same idea that something should be changed, you can achieve that change. And over time, we are probably in a safer world because of it. And that's another episode of Stories Past, a collection of personal experiences that I've told to my students over the last 4 decades. I've chosen these stories because they were funny, inspirational, or maybe amazing. Please keep a lookout for more upcoming episodes or go back and binge the stories you missed if you want. This is Blake Smith, and you've just been told one of my stories past.